Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome back to the Beauty and the Beast Physical Therapy and Strength Conditioning Podcast. I am joined by my co-host, Dr. Ross Schultz.
How's it going, everyone? Happy Wednesday or Thursday by the time you hear this. Hope everyone is having a great spring. We finally got some decent sunshine consistently and some 60, 70, and even 80-degree weather. So it's been fun to be outside. If you remember from last year, Adam, I'm big into grilling. So anytime I can be out back grilling, breakfast, lunch, dinner, it doesn't matter to me. I just go about doing it. How's your spring going?
Pretty good. I found out last weekend that I did not do a good enough job cleaning up the grill last year, so
Grease fire through the roof?
No, unfortunately, it's a relatively new flat top, and I think that I thought that we were going to use it more over the course of the winter, and we never did, so I must not have given it like a thorough enough cleaning, so yeah. I opened it up, rust, so I've got to work that down and get it all up so I can be doing the same thing because I miss.
That's terrible.
Yeah.
So my grill is like 5-6 years old now, and I mean it almost falling apart. But man, I have such a connection with it. It's hard to let it go. I'm at the point now though. Fixing all the parts to it will probably cost me more than buying a new grill.
Yeah. So. We got this one last year because the other one that we had, which was a combo. Propane and charcoal, it just started to rust all over the place. The bottom was falling out of it. So.
Oh, that's when you know you put it to use.
Yeah.
I mean, if I had a broken grill, actually, let me reword this. Summertime, what makes me happy is having my coffee pot and then having my grill. And as I told you right before the show, my coffee pot shit the bed. So, you know, at least I still have the grill. So at least the coffee pot's easy to replace. But this week, Adam and I were we are going to go over a similar podcast that we did from the knee pain one where we broke down classification systems and really provided you guys with educational material so that you could get an idea of how to diagnose yourself and then kind of work through interventions that you could use during the process. So I got some quality feedback from listeners about how they did enjoy that and how they can take that information and use it for themselves. So I thought it would be a good idea to now use some different clinical practice guidelines that are out there, and these are put forth by physical therapy journals. This one's specifically the Journal of Orthopedic and Sports Physical Therapy. And they have these guidelines for multiple body parts, so probably over the next couple weeks or at least episodes, we'll try to go over different body parts. So we'll talk about the different classification schemes, what to look for. Now, we have to remember this does not replace medical information from your PCP, your GP, or an orthopedic surgeon. So, again, we're just trying to educate. So don't think that we are diagnosing you and we're not necessarily giving you the tools to diagnose yourself. If for some reason you have something that is probably serious, you know, we don't want you to just pass it off as just acute low back pain. Again, it's always better to at least go see someone who knows what they're talking about. But once we get through the classification aspect of it, then it's going to be grilling Adam like I did last time. From the training standpoint, we want to figure out, okay, if this person comes in, how would you go about treating them? Because I would probably say, even if we look at the subset of people at Just Get Fit, I'd probably say 80% of them are going to, at any one time, will fall into these categories that we go over today. So I think it's important for strength coaches to recognize that for other PTs who may not follow these classifications, and then also for the trainers who also work with people one-on-one as well. Now, clinical practice guidelines are the recommended treatment guidelines, evaluation guidelines for physical therapists, and we use what are called the ICF classifications. There are many classification systems out there. Classification systems are important because it helps match interventions to what we found. So hopefully the treatment's more effective and hopefully it's more cost effective. And there's multiple classes. There's O'Sullivan's classification system. There's the treatment-based classification system. There's just a bunch of them out there. So the one we'll be talking about today is merely one of them. If anyone's interested, we can always talk about the other ones, but I try not to muddy the waters too much with too many classification systems. So Adam, before we get into the classifications, for you, when someone comes in, and I'm sure you've seen plenty of people with active low back pain. Mm. Now, active means they have a current episode, whether it's acute or chronic. So, you know, we'll just take those terms out of it for now, but we have to define acute versus chronic according to the practice guidelines. In your mind, when someone comes in and says, oh, I got some back pain, what do you look for? And then how do you go about training them and why?
Okay, so the first thing that I am usually asking them is where the pain is. It's happened multiple different times where somebody says, oh, I have back pain. And I will kind of assume lower back pain because you get into the kind, when you hear enough people talk about lower back pain, you kind of start to think that everybody, when they're talking about back pain, is talking about lower back pain, mm-hmm. right? So usually I'll start with just asking where the pain is, because sometimes it's become more evident that, you know, when people think back, I think, you know, like essentially thoracolumbar joint, can't talk today, down.
Yep.
Just because that's where the, but other people, like normal people, will often think just like the entire back. So if somebody like says, oh, my upper back right between my shoulder blades, or like, oh, okay. Not that it's nothing to worry about, but that stuff is just probably, you know, tight, regular tightness. Maybe they worked out and there's something that's tight back there, but it's not something I'm actively concerned about. So start there with the easy stuff. And then, you know, they tell me where it is. Is it to one side or the other? Is it only on their left side? Is it only on their right side? Is it equal on both sides? Is it closer to the hip? Is it closer to the spine? Is it? So that's the first, is just where is the pain? After that, do you have any, is it just tight? Is it sore? Or is there any sort of shooting, stabbing, burning, numbness, anything along those lines? And then from there, I'm usually treating. I'm not treating anybody. I put that in quotes. But I mean, like, my...
treating them from a strength and conditioning
right,
standpoint.
Exactly. The way that I'm treating them from that point is going to be pretty much the same, whether they have back pain or whether they... or, like, just general soreness. And whether they have, you know, numbness, tingling, stinging. And that's just... that's because the first thing I'm going to be doing is try to get them to loosen up, whether it be foam rolling, whether it be a little bit of stretching, assuming that doing one of those things doesn't actively exacerbate the symptom. If they have shooting pain and I put them in a, you know, a pigeon stretch or a 90-90 stretch, or whatever you want to call it, and suddenly it's just like this sharp stabbing pain, it's like, okay, well, all right, get out of that.
Yeah.
You know, maybe we try some foam, whatever. But that's usually where I'm starting kind of regardless of whatever they're presenting.
Yeah. So, and I like the flow that you go through, and you know, whether it's strength and conditioning or whether it's PT, we go through a similar process where we have to ask the appropriate questions and then probably ask a clarifying question, which you ask them where their pain is. It's important, very important to ask that and to clarify. And then from there, we got to try to break it down. Is it serious versus non-serious, or mechanical versus non-mechanical? So we won't go too far in the weeds with that. But at what point do you say, okay, this is more than what I know? You know, you have to go see, you know, health professional X, Y, or Z.
Quite often, if they're not desensitized or having a significant decrease in pain following a decent warm up. And I'm not saying that I'm just like, okay, well, there's nothing else I can do for you today. Get out of here, go make it, and then come back to me. But if that's when my brain starts to think, okay, this may be something that I need to refer out for. You know, if somebody goes through a warm-up and they feel a little bit better, and then as we continue to do some strength exercise, do some mobility stuff, it gets either better or doesn't get worse.
Yeah, green light, go.
Right. But if after the warm-up, they're still feeling a stinging, a burning. A lot of times I'll tell people if they're feeling those types of sensations that they probably should look to talk to someone anyways, because that's more, a little bit more worrisome. But I'm not necessarily forcing them in that direction unless, you know, we get through a few training sessions and it doesn't get any better.
Well, especially with Like, four weeks is my cutoff, at least from my standpoint.
Yeah.
If I see someone 4 weeks and there's no change in their symptoms, all right, we need another set of eyes on you. Let's refer you out. Make sure there's something else not going on that is preventing success in physical therapy. So I think most people appreciate that. You know, it sucks you can't get them better, but it's like, listen, I'm not going to waste your time.
Right.
Let's get this checked out, you know. No harm, no foul. You know, they do their testing and they say, no, you're fine. All right, either this is going to take more time, or I'm not pushing you hard enough, or I'm not educating you to the point that you feel comfortable pushing yourself more. So I've seen both scenarios. Now, I think the way that you go about looking at it is good, and I'm sure you've seen your share of people acute versus chronic. Now, formerly they would break it down into three categories: acute, subacute, and chronic. They're now getting away from that because they said there's really it's hard to define subacute.
I was going to say that seems like it would be hard to define.
Yeah, and I forget what the old numbers were, but essentially anything less than 6 weeks is considered acute. Anything more than 6 weeks is chronic at this point. You know, and I think the old definition of chronic was anything that lasted longer than 90 days or recurred for greater than 6 months.
Okay.
So that was the old definition, but now at 6 weeks, boom, it's chronic. Okay, fine. They've now taken that definition and they've applied it to the different classification schemes, which are now low back pain with mobility deficits, low back pain with movement coordination impairment. So let's think like stability or motor control. Low back pain with referred lower extremity pain, low back pain with radiating pain. And then there's two more that we won't really get into today, but and that's just because they include more psychosocial variables, more true chronic pain, central sensitization. We won't talk about that today. But it's low back pain with related cognitive or affective tendencies, and then chronic low back pain with generalized pain. So those last two we're not going to dig into, but those are six categories that we have to know. So classifying the acute versus chronic is pretty simple. You just ask the person, how long has this been going on for? Okay, great, we're going to get our answer. But now we got to try to figure out, because now with these classification systems, we now can match our interventions. We'll just go down the list for the first four that we talked about. So low back pain with mobility deficits. So they said that this is generally going to be acute. So less than 6 weeks, we're generally not going to see a chronic condition with mobility deficits, because at that point, it's probably going to turn into a motor control problem. We should have the onset of symptoms is often linked to a recent unguarded or awkward movement or position. Now, are you more likely to see, or I won't say are you more likely, have there been scenarios where a patient has said, oh, I blew up my back or threw up my back, and I was merely sneezing or picking up a pencil?
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Sure. So I hear that all the time. But a lot of them, what they say beforehand is, but I was doing 8 hours worth of yard work first.
Right.
Well, that was probably your quote unquote guarded position. And then when you go to pick up a pencil, you don't think about it. So then, boom. So you already worked yourself up to your threshold. You didn't think about it. So, and then all of a sudden, that was just the that little bit too much that sent you the over the edge. So I hear that a lot. When you're dealing someone from a training standpoint that has this more acute low back pain with mobility deficits, so again, acute pain, unguarded, you know, they're probably going to be more guarded at that point because it is acute. What would your first thought be for training? Because we see a lot of people that look like this. So let's just say, you know, you have someone, whether it's online training or think back to your time at GetFit, you're there in person and you can physically watch them work out. Where would you begin?
So we'll just move past the foam rolling, the stretching stuff, because that's where I start pretty much everybody. For somebody that's online training, I usually will add a little bit of additional stretching or mobility work just to, I don't know if overkill is quite the right word, but that's how I tend to think about it. You know, the normal, you know, looking at the training, the normal person, if I had them do this, should be as loose as humanly possible. So I'm adding, like if you know, if I'm looking at this and I'm giving this to somebody who's had some back pain, I'm looking at it through the lens of like, okay, if they're still tight and sore after this, then I need to be drastically changing training. Beyond that, I may decrease the load from some of the exercises, more of the hip-based exercises or anything that involves stabilization through that area, because it's probably going to be a little bit pissed off.
Sure.
Depending on where they're at, I may take much in the way of explosiveness out of that training session. I'm thinking like things like kettlebell swings, jumps, stuff that's going to be real jarring.
Sure. And would you say that's more of a specific type of training when you include that in someone's training program?
Yeah. So usually when I'm going through, it's the stretching, it's the mobility, it's the foam rolling kind of over the top, see if we can get them loose past that point. And then it's still strength. I mean, there really isn't a massive difference in the type of training that I would be doing. It'll just depend on, I may lessen the volume or the load, with the exception of the explosive stuff, I would probably take out. If somebody said, you know, sent me a message on a Monday and said, last night I was finishing up yard work and I bent down to pick something up and I threw my back out. Okay, on Monday I'm probably going to take away swings, jumps, something like that.
Yeah.
And if at the end of the workout, without the swings and the jumps, they were like, by the end of it, I felt totally fine, then, you know, maybe we go one or two more days on that same pattern. And if they report the same thing, you know, their back isn't acting up, then, okay, I feel comfortable working some of that in small portions.
Sure.
Again, make sure it's not a problem before, so on and so forth. It's a bit of a linear movement or pattern.
Well, you basically, all the matched interventions with the exception of joint mobilizations, you basically said everything that this clinical practice guideline has suggested. So it talks about soft tissue mobilization and massage. In your case, you can teach them how to do that with a lacrosse ball, foam roller, whatever it may be. Active education and advice to pursue an active lifestyle is strongly recommended.
Yeah.
So keep them moving.
Yep.
So never tell them. Yeah, walking.
Yep, that's another thing.
When you look at any low back pain article, when you're looking at interventions, the one consistent intervention that is always positive is walking.
Hmm.
You know, and that's probably a strong blood flow to the area. There are probably some neurophysiologic effects from it, but you're moving. There's no other way to describe it. So I always suggest walking for people in acute pain. The reason I asked you about the specific exercise training is because, or let me back that up. Do you think for this patient, acute mobility deficits, do you think specific trunk exercises are better than general exercises?
With general mobility deficits? Possibly.
Can be possibly, but they're saying with this person, we actually don't need to be specific with trunk exercises, but we need to exercise.
Right. Yeah.
So when you said, oh, I'll take out the plyo stuff, that's why I said specific.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah.
So I was going to circle back around to that.
Yeah, okay.
But this just says, yes, keep them training. Just keep it general. Go through the motions. You know, you don't have to load them up. You know, if it hurts to flex, take out exercises that they're flexing too deep. Mm-hmm. You know, if it hurts to extend, all right, make sure that we have a nice braced core if we're going to be doing that. You know, work the muscles around the area, work the hips, make sure that the glutes are firing, make sure that the hamstrings and quads are working. You know, practice good mechanics. You know, all those things come into play. So when we hear that, think about the number of people that don't work out when they have acute pain.
Yeah.
So, oh, I can't do this. Oh, I can't do that. You know, the fucking I can't attitude that a lot of people have, they don't realize that apprehension is then causing deconditioning that then is making them weaker over the long run.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not saying people have to get in and be a strong man and lift an Atlas stone that's 350 pounds, but if you're always falling victim to that, you know, and you've had acute pain.
Mm-hmm.
I've had acute pain. I've taken a day or two off and said, listen, I'm going to let this calm down. But you bet your ass I'm back in here modifying my exercises. You know, and you and I are probably at a distinct advantage just because we've been doing this for so long. We know immediately how we're going to modify our workouts.
Right.
And at the very least, we're going to try something. If it hurts, then we modify.
Right.
But there's never a time, or can you think of the last time where you came into a workout program and you just flat out said, ah, screw it, I'm just not doing it?
The only time that that happens to me is when I get pissed off.
Well, that's psychosocial.
Exactly, that's why I started laughing, because it doesn't really count. But that's the only reason I'll do that, is if I'm getting pissed off that I can't lift a weight because my back hurts. Fuck this, I'm done.
Yeah.
But that I think is one of the biggest differences that I've made in my training over the last, probably eight-ish years. I'm trying to remember when I had my moderate disc herniation. Would have been about 6-7 years ago now. And that, because it was just such a new sensation at the time, that, you know, I stopped doing much in the way of deadlifting. I stopped a little bit more of the explosive stuff, just because, like, new pain sensation, I didn't really understand it. And now looking back, I think a lot of part of the reason that my back has not been a consistent concern since then is because now if I wake up with back pain, I go, I work out, I try and loosen it up, I see how it goes, and because I have been more consistent, my back pain is significantly decreased, and it doesn't last.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'll wake up sore maybe the next morning after some heavy deadlifts, but it's usually gone by the following day.
And then some soreness is going to be, it's normal.
Right.
You know, we have to recognize that. You know, a lot of people, I think, believe, and I just did a quick post on my Facebook group, and I'm going to actually do one for Get Fit, about should I feel my back the day after deadlifting. Mm-hmm. I think people don't recognize that pain-free and strain-free are two different things.
Yeah.
We want to be pain-free during working out. It's impossible, if you are pushing yourself, it's impossible to be strain-free. So if we're pushing ourselves hard enough, we're pushing close to that threshold where, yes, we're causing microtrauma, it needs to adapt, and then we get stronger. That's the stress adaptation response. There's nothing new about this. We've known about this response forever. We've talked about it ad nauseum. And then the next time you've built up an adaptation, you give yourself a new stimulus, it's not going to be as bad until you go and grossly exceed what you've been doing, or you completely change up your entire training program.
Yeah.
So, normal. Now, if you deadlift and you have pain 10 days later, not normal.
Right.
There's a complete difference. So I always give people that 72-hour window where it's, okay, hey, this is normal. Give it 72 hours. That's when the tension, pain, discomfort, whatever you call it, should decrease, and then you're usually good to go. And for the most part, knock on wood, people usually follow that pattern. All right, next grouping. So low back pain with movement coordination impairments. So these can be acute exacerbations or acute on chronic exacerbations that are usually, there's a low back pain component that have a referred lower extremity pain pattern. I usually think soft tissue, muscle knots, but we also have to think it can be discogenic in nature. It could also be facet joint, which is pretty common. What we'll typically also see with that is that we have numerous episodes, which again will have the back-related lower extremity pain. And the big thing is with that, there should not be any type of numbness sensation. There shouldn't be any loss of strength or sensation or tendon reflexes. So that's a different group that we'll talk about. Now, if you have someone that comes in with a movement coordination impairment, what types of things are the patient presenting with that you assume that there's that coordination impairment? There's usually one big one, or two things that I see that if I didn't even know what I was looking at, I would still guess it's a stability problem.
I mean, balance.
Sure.
What are the two things you're thinking of? I'm having a hard time coming up with exactly.
Yeah, so they'll have an aberrant motion, and that's defined as they kind of go down and it catches.
Okay.
So yep. They lean forward and like, ooh.
Yep.
Or as they go back up, you see them walking up their thighs.
Yeah.
It's called the Gower sign.
Okay.
When people do that, I'm like, this is a motor control problem. Absolutely, it's a motor control problem. And there are some other things that we can look at to classify someone. I won't say diagnose them. Typically, if they have a straight, active straight leg raise that's greater than 90 degrees, then that also means they're hypermobile. Then there's another test that we use. It's a prone instability test. That's not anything that you would use, but it's that usually that ouch, there's a catch, and then walk up their thighs. So how would you go about if someone was showing movement coordination impairments? How would you go about training them? Again, let's say this is day one that you met them. What is your focus that day?
Staying slow and controlled. Whether that be literally slowing the exercises down. I mean, a lot of the training principles are going to stay pretty much the same. I'm not necessarily going through explosive movements because where the other person may not have the mobility to do it, this person may not be able to control the mobility or the movement itself and may end up in pain. But outside of that, slowing it down, maybe working on end range positions, you know, wall sits aren't exactly what I mean, but just for a picture, you know, something where they can get to the bottom, they can be controlled at the bottom of their end ranges and hold it there, or going slow through a movement, or things along those lines. These are the people that I'm very rarely stretching. They're foam rolling. They're doing some activation type stuff. Activation meaning like just getting the muscles to fire in a certain way. Mm-hmm. But I'm not necessarily trying to stretch them because they don't have enough tissue. I can't think of the way I'm trying to say this. But their flexibility is not their problem. Yeah. Their ability to control their flexibility is the problem.
Yep. So I love how you focused on the slow and controlled, because with this grouping, it is suggested that we use more endurance-based exercises. So whether that's high repetition, lighter weight, or just the activation part. Mm. So whether we call it specific trunk activation or whether we call it endurance exercises, you know, it's all about parameters and kind of your intent. But this group actually does do well with specific trunk exercises compared to the mobility group, where it says general is fine to do. Go ahead and just knock yourself out. What are some specific trunk exercises that you like to give? And let's say if someone was acute versus chronic, what would those specific trunk exercises look like for you?
So acute versus chronic, chronic, I'm not as afraid of doing offset work, whether it be like the two that are coming to mind are farmer's carries or farmer's holds. So like somebody that has a more chronic issue, I probably wouldn't necessarily be afraid to try doing like some offset farmer's walk. So like holding a weight on one side but not on the other.
Yep.
Whereas somebody that's more acute, I'd probably want to try and keep them as balanced as possible and just work on stacking the joints in general, not necessarily creating a off-center resistance.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, for me, by the time someone comes in with an acute problem, usually they and it depends on irritability, how fast it gets set off and how fast it comes down. I have the luxury of having the high-low table, so I'll probably start in supine with more of an acute individual. Mm-hmm. Chronic, they found with individuals that have true chronic pain that typically their pain intensity at its worst, it may be constant, but it's not high.
Right.
And also their perception of disability is actually not as high as we would expect. So I'm okay pushing them, you know, and our focus should be on the task and not about pain, because we want to build up functional tolerance. So in the case that someone's chronic, I usually start them with, you know, all the anti-rotation, anti-extension, start them there in a nice static position, get them moving, and then I'll start doing, I like the farmer's carries, we talked about that. I also like med ball stuff for them. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to be as concerned about the quick plyometrics, but I would not do that with the acute stabilization group.
Right.
It's just, if they can't bend down without that aberrant motion, then they are not going to be able to whip a ball as fast as they can. So chronic, you know, like you said, I'm not going to be as concerned to kind of let loose with them. So now the next group is we're looking at the referred lower extremity pain group. Now, this is going to sound very similar to the radiating pain group, but there are some differences. So the related referred lower extremity pain is commonly associated referred buttock, thigh, or leg pain that worsens with flexion-based activities and sitting.
Okay.
I mean, that sounds like me quite often. Now, for these individuals, and the only thing that really changes as far as someone with more chronic pain, of course, it's an acute on, they would report multiple episodes. So this is going to be more acute as well. For someone who has known sensitivity with flexion, so they have a flexion sensitivity, what exercise are you going to avoid?
I'm trying to think. Because there's not a lot of stuff that I really do that's super flexion based. But if you want to get into stuff that I would stay away from, I mean, like crunches, sit-ups, which
even,
I suppose...
Is that even an option?
Almost the same thing. Yeah, I don't even necessarily think of those as options. But let's see, flexion based stuff. I mean, I'm probably going a little bit lighter on things like deadlifts and bridges to make sure that they're maintaining a neutral spine.
Okay, so let's go with the deadlift for a second.
Okay.
Would you teach a conventional deadlift or a Romanian deadlift?
Probably a Romanian deadlift.
Why?
Because they're going to have a hard time not going into flexion at the bottom of that traditional deadlift.
Correct.
From the floor.
Correct. Now, if someone has low back pain, acute or chronic for that matter, in your opinion, do you feel like they should be deadlifting?
Absolutely.
Why?
Because the weaker your posterior chain, the backside of your body gets, the harder it is to... almost said the harder it is to strengthen your back, which is essentially the same thing twice. But the harder it is to put your body in position to offset that pain or to get rid of that pain.
It's never going to get fucking stronger.
Yep.
And so...
it's just going to get worse.
We've said before, squatting is not bad for you. Bad squatting is bad for you. Running is not bad for you. Bad running is bad for you. Deadlifting is the same. Deadlifting is not bad for you. Shitty, poor, no one taught you how to do it, deadlifting is bad for you. The one thing I do love about Romanian deadlifts is they are self-correcting.
Yep.
If you do it wrong, your body's going to let you know immediately, especially if you have back pain. If you do it right, your back should not hurt at all. And that's assuming you're using an appropriate weight. You don't want to be an asshole and lift 700 pounds on an RDL.
Right. But at the same time, if you're trying to do that and you're trying to be and you're being an asshole, your body's going to self-correct and tell you. So it's just going to be a lot worse.
That's true. So I always tell people, if you have back pain, you should be deadlifting. And that's usually when I get the cross eyes and, you know, that, oh my God, you shouldn't be saying that. I've had back pain multiple times since the age of 19, and you know there are some days where I go lighter.
Yeah.
But I'm not taking deadlifts out. You know, also for myself, I have very short legs. I'm closer to the ground, so it was almost like I'm better at deadlifting anyways. So I don't have to worry about it. But there are plenty of times where I've had pain where it's I'm going to try it. You round your back too much, your back's going to hate you. You use that hip hinge appropriately, your back does not bother you.
Yep.
I've seen more people butcher the deadlift than any other lift.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, squats, for the most part, those are butchered. But the deadlift, I just think that's... if there's ever an exercise that people screw up, it is that.
Yeah.
Can you think of another exercise that people screw up as much or more?
It's not as severe, but I see a lot of funky looking push-ups.
just thinking push-ups, but I usually think that's more lazy and
that's it's not the same. But no, I can't really
the
think
the people
of,
that leave their stomach on the ground
or
their pelvis.
Yeah.
My back hurts. I don't know why, because you're just doing a cobra stretch.
Right.
All right, so we get this person. We talked about things we would avoid. Now, what exercise or what focus are you going to put on this person in their training program if they did have this type of referred lower extremity pain?
So, again, things to strengthen the posterior chain, deadlifts, rows, chins. I mean, chins, assuming they're able to do chins. But
I'd be fine with it.
Hamstring curls of some kind.
Yep.
And probably just things that are going to help get them out of much of a flexion posture, or, you know, so things like, let me think. I don't know, I use a lot of them. What would you do?
Well, what I wanted to point out with that, and the reason why I didn't want to kind of lead you down that path, is because for those of you listening, he basically picked neutral spine exercises. Mm-hmm. Take them out of flexion, put them in neutral spine. Assuming we are in an appropriate neutral spine, natural curves, the muscles in the front will equal the muscles in the back, and it still provides stability. Mm-hmm. At the very least, we're getting facilitation through those muscles, you know, especially with specific trunk exercises. Like, I do a lot of standing rows, but I treat it like a specific trunk exercise. Okay, go ahead and get the shoulder blades back. All right, let's go ahead and brace or tighten your glutes. But if we do all this correctly, all these exercises are specific trunk exercises.
Yep.
Now, is it the same as laying on the table, sucking your belly button in towards your stomach and doing heel taps? No, and that's called a transverse abdominis drawn maneuver. And those are okay. But I'd rather get someone up and brace them, you know, again, like our Pavlov press, but in a nice neutral position.
Yeah.
We can't let the body go forward. But all the exercises you picked, I think those are great. And I'm still a fan of just banded exercises, presses, rows, pull downs, but really having to focus on let's keep that center, you know, nice and neutral, nice and rigid, stiff, controlled, whatever you choose to call it.
How do you feel about side planks in those scenarios?
Maybe
not as a... I realize that I kind of... I'm jumping around a little bit because that's a little bit more lateral than it is.
I'm not against them. The only way I'd really be against them is if you automatically knew that side bending hurts.
Right.
Or if they have a cranky shoulder that won't allow weight to be planted through it. So other than that, I'm a fan of them.
Yeah.
You know, especially having someone bend their knees, doing a modified
like a
side plank. Yeah, so I think they're great exercises. And for those people who are Stuart McGill purists,
right.
You know, you have
that's why it came to mind.
Yeah, so you have the curl up, which is the modified plank, and the side plank, and the bird dog, which essentially is going to offer the greatest amount of stability with the least amount of stress on the spine. So I'm still a huge fan of those exercises. Mm-hmm. My classification systems have changed a little bit since originally reading Stuart McGill's Low Back Disorders book.
Mm-hmm.
But I still think a lot of the EMG study research that he did to show specific trunk activation patterns, once we get to performance, I think, you know, he was spot on when it came to that stuff. Now we have the acute, and this will be the last subgrouping we go over, and then we will talk about training, probably just shoot the shit. But now we have low back pain with radiating pain. So yes, we had referred lower extremity pain in the last group, but that's generally not going to be associated with a nerve.
Mm-hmm.
So we talked about the disc, we talked about the facet joints.
Yeah, that sucks.
Now when we have radiating pain, we can have what's called radicular pain versus radiculopathy.
Mm-hmm.
Radiculopathy, generally you have to have a decrease in dermatome, sensation, myotomes, strength, and your deep tendon reflexes are affected as well, or muscle stretch reflexes, they're called that as well. But it lets us know a group of nerves are being affected. We can have radiculopathy without having pain.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if someone does have a dermatome pattern, so a band of tissue or a band of pain going down their leg, and it follows a dermatomal pattern, that lets us know that that is the actual pain that's radicular. So you can have radiculopathy with radicular pain or vice versa. But if someone is only showing weakness, then they have radiculopathy but not radicular pain.
Okay.
So they've changed the definitions, I think, in 2009. But usually everyone just says, you have radiculopathy, don't worry about it. And then people will come in and, you know, they have all their neuro exam is normal, but they have that band of pain. I'm like, you don't have a radiculopathy. Well, what do you mean? I'm like, you have radicular pain, but you don't have radiculopathy. So it's just, do they have neuro deficits or not?
Okay. Yep.
And again, if there's neuro deficits without pain, then it's strictly radiculopathy. So we can have this where it's going to be acute and it can be chronic as well. Now, the way we go about treating them are pretty much the same. Now, from a PT standpoint, it's not necessarily going to be the same, because then we got to try to figure out, can someone centralize versus peripheralize? Do they need traction? Those aren't things that you would necessarily look at. But let's say we have someone comes in with sciatica. Mm-hmm. That's the most commonly known radiculopathy. So it's actually radicular pain until we see those neural deficits. How do you go about training someone with sciatica? Because everyone in the world has had it.
So beat the crap out of their hips, with mobility-wise. Again, lacrosse ball, foam roller. If somebody's having it really bad, I also have a band stretch routine that I used to use a ton when I was having a lot of these symptoms when I had my herniation.
Yep.
That it wouldn't necessarily make the symptoms go away for a huge amount of time, but it at least loosened me up enough that I could go through the correct range of motion without having that radicular pain, and just standing up after that, it would be gone for, 15, 20 minutes, whatever it may be. Mm-hmm. For more severe cases, I'll have people do I've always kind of considered it traction, but loop a band up high, put their foot through it, and then scooch their body away, like along the floor, so the band actually creates space through the hip. That was really helpful for me, and is helpful for other people. Outside of that, it doesn't change a lot of the movement and the training principles I do, assuming that I'm not getting that radicular pain. I may include more, because at least in my experience, when people have that, it tends to, you loosen it up, it goes away, but then it comes back. You loosen it up, it goes away, then it comes back. So for somebody who doesn't have that, maybe we're going through foam rolling some, and then it's, deadlift, chest press, squats, whatever, you just go through a list of five exercises, yep, fundamental movements. Whereas this person, it may be we stretch, we do our release, we do our stretch, and then we, do a superset where you deadlift 6-7 reps, whatever it is, and then you foam roll your glutes for 30 seconds aside. Then you deadlift, then you do a little bit. So I put a little bit more of that stuff in there to keep them from going back into that tightened pattern where they get that shooting sensation, yeah, or that
absolutely
particular pain.
For a lot of these people, well, and whether we call it stenosis too, we can have stenosis with radicular symptoms. Generally, they don't like extension,
yeah,
because now it's going to close off the foramen where the nerves live, potentially the disc, but more the nerves with the foramen, if again it's a neural issue. We just try to maintain extension at neutral. The goal is not to flex them forward, although these people sometimes like, repeated knees to chest, things along those lines. Child's pose feels really good. But we can't keep flexing them forever, because then unfortunately it's going to make them look like an old man, right, or an old woman for that matter. So then our goal is to get them back to how much extension can we regain without changing their symptoms. So that's ideal. But they found with this group that general exercise is better than specific trunk activation. So, and I can't say I necessarily agree with that or necessarily disagree with that. I would still add it in, but I think the concept that we talk about a lot that I've mentioned before is severity and irritability. So severity is how high does the pain get and how does it affect your life? So in an example, if you said, I have knee pain, it's an 8 out of 10. That's severe just based on the number alone. Mm-hmm. Now, if you said, I have knee pain, that's a 3 out of 10. Well, just looking at the 3, we're like, it's really not that bad. But if you said, but I'm not running, I'm not climbing stairs, I'm afraid to do this. Well, now it's severe, because now you're apprehensive to do things because of this pain. We got to figure out why. Irritability is how much does it take to piss off the tissue and how long does it take to calm down? So if someone tries their first deadlift, it shoots to an 8, calms immediately down to a 4, but then lingers for 4 days, I'm not too excited about that.
No.
Now, if the first one shot up to an 8 but went right to a 0, all right, try again. Let's see what happens. Oh, the next one went to a 6 but came to a 0. Oh, the more I do it, the better I get. Green light, go.
Yep.
So, we can have high severity, low irritability, and be okay. This is the case of a marathon runner. They get high severity at mile 21. They still have more running to do. So they're in pain. There's no marathon runner I've ever met that has been pain-free that far into the race. But within a couple hours after the race, they usually feel okay. They're tired.
Right, they're beat. But yeah.
You know, they may be walking around because their feet are blistered and whatnot, and they have an acute Achilles strain that they need to limp around on. But the pain that they were feeling during running has calmed down within 2 hours. I mean, especially the average person runs a marathon in, what, 4 or 5 hours?
Yeah.
Somewhere around there? I don't know. I couldn't even tell you.
Yeah, I think that's it.
Because the top-notch guys are like 2 hours right now. It's nuts. And I think with the wind and things like that, I think one guy got under 2 hours in Chicago or New York or one of them. I think it was like 1:59 something. That's insane. He's basically sprinting the whole race.
Yeah.
But if you think it takes, you know, 4 or 5 hours for that severity to go up to an 8, but now it's coming back down within 2 hours, that's a pretty good ratio.
Yeah.
You know, moderate irritability is defined as a 1-to-1 ratio. So it takes 2 hours to come on, takes 2 hours to go away. Where we're concerned is, you know, it takes, you know, 10 minutes to go on, come on, but takes 3 days to go away. All right. That's not right. That's... And then we also have to consider, too, is the strain appropriate for the presentation? So, if someone has no pain walking into the gym, they deadlift 135 pounds 8 times, next day they're like, yeah, my back's, you know, it's kind of sore, it's like a 2 out of 10, I wouldn't think twice about it.
Right.
If someone said, oh, it's a 9 out of 10, it has not changed, all right, one, is it really a 9? Because 9 is your one step from going to the emergency room. Mm-hmm. Or is this something worse that we need to be concerned with? Okay, well, here's the 72-hour rule. If you come out of it, don't worry about it. If it lingers, then we're going to be worried about it. So, and I think that's what a lot of people, regardless of these classification systems that we use, you know, does the exercise hurt? Are there ways that we can modify it to now bring that hurt down? And even if you're in pain, there's still always exercises that we can be doing. You know, again, walking is certainly fine. General exercise is certainly fine. So there's no magic bullet to any of this. It's just being mindful of what you can and can't do. You want to try to limit the amount of apprehension that you do have with each of these exercises, because apprehension makes it worse. Mm. Even if you are apprehensive and you try an exercise, it's going to be compensated. And that's the unfortunate part. So for me, when I say, hey, let's try this, and when they give me that, okay, I'm not forcing it.
Yeah.
Whereas if they say, okay, I'll try it, all right, let's go ahead and try it and see how it goes. Because, you know, we can't account for the human psyche. You know, that's really the big thing to remember. Now, are there any other training recommendations that you would give for just the general public, because a lot of my stuff, and we'll talk with general training principles, the PT stuff is all hands-on stuff I'd have to do anyways.
Yeah, I would say that, and I don't know if this is exactly what you mean, but if you find, I'd say at least at the beginning, try to stay away from too much in the way of rotational stuff. I don't even necessarily mean like explosive stuff, but just rotational movements, depending on how it feels. Kind of my gauge has always been, if you have to gear yourself up to do a specific movement that's not like a big movement. Like mm-hmm. when you're walking up to a deadlift bar, sometimes you gotta, you know, kinda like clap your hands a little bit, maybe like on the side, you know, like just little, sometimes you do
like a
need
power
that,
lifter.
Like, right. I mean, and I'm not even talking that much, but if you are going to do Russian twists, for example, or some sort of, or like a chop that involves some sort of shoulder rotation, and before you even start that movement, you find yourself going, you know, it probably isn't something you should do right now, mm-hmm. just because you're apprehensive about it. And then the explosive stuff. Outside of that, it's a lot of, and it makes it sound like it's so not a science, but it still is. It's a lot of trial and error. Making things as safe as they can be within a certain, you know, if you're doing kettlebell swings and you were kettlebell swinging a 96-pound kettlebell 2 weeks ago, but since then you've hurt your back. Doesn't mean don't try kettlebell swings. It means try. It might mean, I don't want to say everybody's different, but it might mean try kettlebell swings with a 40, or a, you know, 44, whatever the whatever the kettlebell is. It doesn't sure. mean be afraid of doing everything. It just means be measured in your attempt to do the same thing.
Be smart about it.
Right.
You know, that's the important part. So, you know, you definitely went down the right path that I was hoping for. You know, I always tell people it's okay to go slower.
Yeah.
There's, you know, no one's going to stand over you and scream at you and say, if you don't go fast, you're going to die today. Go slower. See how you feel. Reduce the range of motion.
Yeah.
Find a range that feels good, or at least doesn't exacerbate your symptoms. Lighten the weight. Decrease the number of sets. Decrease the reps. Don't work the body part that is bothering you. You know, low back pain, great, work your hips. Now, I know they're right next to each other, but there are plenty of hip exercises that you can do that you're not going to necessarily directly be working your back muscles. There's plenty of great upper body exercises that we can do that we don't have to stress the low back.
I mean, you can have back pain doing a deadlift. You could have back pain doing a 300-pound deadlift and go over and put 300 pounds on a bar and do a hip thrust and be fine.
Yeah. So you just never know. I mean, the effects of gravity on the spine, mm-hmm. maybe laying on a bench and doing dumbbell stuff there works. Even using like a split squat position generally helps people because that can keep more of a neutral spine. I think that's one thing that I do try to focus on. If someone has acute back pain, I'd rather see them do lunge variations than squats.
Yep.
You know, just because they're not going to feel comfortable sitting their hips back as much, mm-hmm. so they just end up dumping forward. Oh, I feel that in my back. Well, let's go into a split squat position, give you a wider base of support, and all I want you to do is just drop down between your feet. People generally do well with that. And I know for me personally, if my back is talking to me, usually the first thing to go is going to be squats.
Yeah.
You know, deadlifts I'll still do, but maybe not a heavy conventional, but I'll still do RDLs. I like those a lot, or I'll do a banded deadlift. But I'm always putting lunges in there. It's a great way to still build up my glutes and my quads, but it just allows me to actually, this is a time where vertical and straight are the same thing.
Right.
Whereas, unfortunately, with squatting, we know that vertical and straight are, we don't want them to be the same thing, but when we're in pain, it's hard to create that neutral position. So I just tend to avoid it. Even with a goblet squat to create core activation, if it's really acute, then I won't even... it's just not worth the risk. I also know a lot of people that will say, you know, I can't come to the gym, but I'm going to go try yoga instead. I'm not against it.
Mm-hmm.
There are a good amount of positions that if someone's lit up, I'm not sure yoga would be the best for. Now, I'm a fan of yoga. Love
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's great. But chronic pain, I'm not too concerned with. But it's more acute pain. You know, oh, my back, I'm going to yoga. There are a lot of positions that people can't necessarily get into in the beginning. So if you're willing to try yoga with an acute back episode, there's absolutely no reason why you can't lift weights. Now, people say, well, there's external weights. It's more load on the spine. I understand that.
It's also, but you're also standing in less compromised positions, or moving, or whatever.
That's exactly what's going to be my point next.
Sorry, I cut you off there.
No, you made my next point for me. You know, at least we, with strength training,
mm-hmm.
at least we can manipulate the body and put it in the most advantageous positions. Now, and of course, in yoga, if you have a good instructor, they'll be able to do that as well. But just based off of the movements that I've taken in beginner's classes in yoga with no back pain, I can't imagine doing some of those with acute low back pain. Not that I would want to either. But so just for those of you who psychologically you say, you know, oh, I can't do this, but I can do that. Take a step back and really analyze that, because oftentimes it's actually going to be more stress on your body. You just think that it's not as much.
Right.
So I'm not saying don't do it, but there are always two sides to a coin. So All right, so that's it as far as the classification are concerned. I think we said a lot about training recommendations. We gave certain ideas. Now, we didn't get too far into specifics with exercises. So if anyone's interested, you can certainly reach out. You know, we could be here all day. This is what we do. So we could just rattle off exercises like there's no tomorrow. And you guys just don't want to have to listen to us after a while. So hopefully you took, you know, away from today the ability to recognize kind of what you're dealing with as far as acute and chronic, whether it is something more of a stability problem versus potentially something's being compromised causing leg symptoms versus mobility deficits, what you can work on to continue going to the gym, and then potentially, you know, how to modify your own programs to allow you to progress and continue strengthening. Because we saw that general exercise training is good for us, but also the advice to stay active, that to me is huge. So even if people don't want to go to the gym, stay active, go for a walk, get on your bike, go do something. You know, just don't sit around. It's actually been shown with low back pain, if you lay in bed for longer than 2 days or stay off your feet, it's actually detrimental. So 2 days should really be the maximum that people kind of chill out and do nothing. So. Anything else on your part?
No, I think good.
All right, excellent. So wrapped up another great episode with our classification systems on low back pain. So hopefully you guys get as much out of this one as you did with the patellofemoral pain syndrome. We haven't decided yet what the next one's going to be, but you know, just know that we'll come back with the same great content to try to help you guys stay healthier and fitter into your later years as well. So all the information will be at the bottom of the page like it normally is. For those of you who are on my Fit for Life group page, I made an announcement that I won't be doing the scheduled Ask Ross Anythings anymore. So I'm just going to be doing random Facebook Lives when questions come in. So if you're currently not a member and you want to sign up to the group, certainly feel free. But there won't be any of the scheduled ones anymore. So it just kind of gives me a little bit more freedom to answer everyone's questions, and I don't have to be stuck around my computer on a Thursday night. So all Adam's information will be there. You can email him if you have any questions for us. You guys have been with us long enough now. You know the drill. And until next week, stay healthy.
Later, guys.